Iku Iluna, please rise.
Ia ka aha o o kolo kolo ki eki hana hano ua a ko koa ho mai la. This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Verina, makamoku kuni o oahu I kamoku o kona e ano ka koma a lio lani hale. Greetings on the island of Oahu in the district of Kona. We are gathered here at a lio lani hale. Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-22-0000687. Gerardo Dennis Patrickson et al. Respondents, plaintiffs, appellants versus Dow Chemical Company and Del Monte Fresh Produce, petitioners, defendants, appellees, and Dole Food Company et al. Respondents, defendants, appellees. Arguing for petitioners, Dow Chemical Company and Del Monte Fresh Produce, Michael Brehm. Also appearing is David Chi and Stephen Goto. Arguing for respondents, Gerardo Dennis Patrickson et al., Jonathan Macy. Also appearing is Keith Kiuchi and Scott Hendler. Argument on the merits.
All right. Aloha kakahiaka. Good morning. Today's proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. And I'd like to welcome our substitute justice in this case, Judge Taryn Tomasa. Thank you for being here. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. The court has allowed 30 minutes for each side. And let's see. Just to confirm, Mr. Brehm, I understand you intend to argue for 20 minutes, and you have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct? Yes. And Mr. Massey, you have 30 minutes with a five-minute warning, correct?
Yes.
All right. We will go ahead and proceed. Mr. Brehm, please proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Mike Brehm, and I'm from Houston, Texas. I am representing the petitioners, the Dow Chemical Company and Del Monte. We're here on two separate issues that the court has granted our application for certiorari. The first one is a straightforward reversal by the Court of Appeals on the trial court's granting of our motion for summary judgment. On that motion, we believe strongly that there is no evidence of Mr. Jimenez-Arias's exposure, much less evidence sufficient to present an issue of material fact. On the second issue, which is the court's reversal of the trial court's exclusion of one of plaintiff's experts, Michael DeBartolomas, it is our position that the Court of Appeals erred. It simply applied the wrong analysis and applied the wrong standard of review. On both of those, I would like to proceed, if I may.
Yes.
All right. On the first issue, the Court of Appeals made a straightforward ruling. It said the respondent, Mr. Jimenez-Arias, presented excerpts from his deposition that proved he worked for 6 or 7 days a week for over 2 years on a Del Monte plantation. And that is the extent of what the Court of Appeals said about his exposure. They then said that they also considered adverse health effects or adverse effects of this alleged exposure on his health. The Court of Appeals did not mention any DBCP. It did not mention the presence of DBCP on any farm on which Mr. Jimenez-Arias said he worked. Now, on the excerpts from his testimony, I would urge the court, if the court has not done so, it's not much reading. There's only 19 pages in those excerpts. Only 15 deal with his work on the farm. None of those talk about his exposure to DBCP. Mr. Jimenez-Arias, frankly, had never seen DBCP. On the question or the other point that they raised, the adverse effects on his health, there's no mention of what adverse effects we're talking about. It's a complete blank. at a minimum, just for these reasons, given what the Court of Appeals said it relied on, the court should reverse and remand. But let's go further. Let's credit the evidence that the plaintiffs have cited, that they presented to the trial court and cited in their response to our motion, or our petition for writ of certiorari. They put this all under a heading of something they say is ample evidence of exposure to DBCP. It begins on the very last line of page 2 of their response and carries over onto page 3. And the first of it is straightforward. It's something that the Court of Appeals, in fact, cited, that he had worked on various farms, rotating through for a few years. But then it goes on to quote one of the excerpts, and he talks about that he went to that he not only worked there, but he would inspect the fruit, and then he would go into the fields in the afternoon with an administrator. And they quote that in its entirety. But then the very next line, the very next question and answer from that deposition excerpt is, did you ever see anybody applying pesticides? And the answer, no, an unequivocal no. So we know Mr. Jimenez-Arias never saw anybody applying pesticides. That would obviously include DBCP.
Counsel, just a quick question here. Is it the position then that the only way to have exposure is to be there when it's being applied?
Your Honor, that's going to raise the entire point of my argument, I believe. If what we know, when I can finish this recitation, what we will see is that the only evidence of that could possibly be raised to raise a genuine issue or an issue of genuine material fact would be that he was on a farm at the same time that the product was applied. But it really doesn't even go that far. What we know is we have a man who rotated across 18 farms roughly once a week. And he did that for 2 or 2.5 years. And when he was rotating through those farms, we also know from other evidence uncited by the Court of Appeals that DBCP was applied in this rotation 2 times a year for 2 months at a time.
What about the chemical being on the product as that he is inspecting? Is it clear in the evidence that there's no way that exposure can happen in that manner?
Other way around, Your Honor. That's merely a conclusory allegation by the plaintiffs. There is zero evidence in this record that there is any DBCP on the fruit itself that he would have encountered while he was inspecting cut bananas.
Circumstantial evidence cannot be considered?
Your Honor, what would that circumstantial evidence be linked to? What would it take to get from no evidence at all that there's DBCP on the fruit? We know that it was applied. We don't know if it was applied when the fruit was ripe. We don't know if it was applied after any rainfall, or was there any rainfall that would have washed it off? There's simply nothing there to make that leap beyond pure speculation.
What about his testimony that he would sleep in the warehouses where the DBCP was being stored?
I want to talk about that at some length, Your Honor, because that is in the next few pages of the excerpts. What he says in particular is that what he saw there, and this is on exhibit, it's RTAB 2C, exhibit 1 at 108, 12 through 25. He says he would go in there in the warehouse and they would sleep on sacks. Your Honor, DBCP is a liquid. DBCP came in 30-gallon drums back when it was sold 50 years ago. Because he's then asked in that same excerpt, what chemicals were stored in the warehouse that you were talking about taking a break in? I don't know. I imagine that they were the ones used on the banana plantations. He's then asked, do you remember the names of any of the chemicals? No, but I do know that there were chemicals there. But the only ones he could identify, at least the only containers he could identify, were bags. Bags of something else that's certainly not DBCP. And in that excerpt about him being in there, well, let me go back. That's just another unsupported allegation of counsel. Because that when you look at the evidence, every time we do this, I'm going to point the court to the actual evidence. The actual evidence is going to be his deposition testimony and his discovery responses about what he did. In those excerpts, you'll see nothing about his exposure, about him being able to testify about his own exposure. There's no mention of DBCP because he never saw DBCP, doesn't know the names of any of the chemicals. There's no mention of any of the things that he did. But the context is offered by our summary judgment evidence before the circuit court.
Counsel, if I can ask you, wasn't the testimony also included that there was chemicals there? And it was where they stored all the chemicals that were used in the banana plantation. Why can't a reasonable inference be drawn from that testimony?
Because the only one he identified, Your Honor, are sacks. He could not identify the actual chemical being in that warehouse. He says he imagines that they were those chemicals, but he doesn't know. Imagine's the key word there. What we're having to do is speculate that the chemicals that were there were DBCP. And let's remember.
So you're saying that no reasonable inference.
There's no reasonable inference. And let me go further, Your Honor. Again, we know from plaintiff's evidence that DBCP was applied 2 months a year, twice. And so it's not always in the warehouse. It's in the warehouse when they need it. So we don't know when he was in the warehouse. We don't know what else might have been in that warehouse. But there, you cannot make a reasonable inference from what we have in his actual testimony. The evidence itself does not support the allegations that are made. It is not a reasonable inference that he was there when DBCP was there. But say he was. It comes in a closed drum. I mean, how would it get out of the closed drum? It's not a compound that is sitting around open. And you can get that from...
And Del Monte did admit that it applied the... a DBCP through 18 farms, in their cycles, the two-month cycles twice a year. He's rotating around. His job is to inspect the sprayed produce. Why wouldn't there be a reasonable inference under those facts that he was exposed?
Well, Your Honor, I must offer a correction. This pesticide was not sprayed. It is injected into the ground. It's a soil fumigant. So it is not ever sprayed widely over the bananas. It's not sprayed by hand. It's not sprayed by a crop.
Okay,
duster.
But it goes into whatever the fruit is. And I think he testified about bananas. So whether it's sprayed or not, isn't there some of the DBCP liquid, I guess, in that banana that he would have inspected as part of his job?
There is no evidence of that at all, Your Honor.
Is there evidence that he inspected banana produce, and is there evidence that the DBCP was injected in the produce?
Not in the produce, Your Honor. But what DBCP does, it is what is called a nematicide, and there are small worms that attack the root systems of banana plantations. Some people say they're microscopic, but they aren't really, and they burrow into the roots. So the DBCP is always in the ground. Even if you assume some of it comes out of the ground, what are we talking about? We don't know how much. We don't know anything. It's all speculation that it would be on the covers of on the outside of the bananas when he was inspecting them. None of their experts say that. This is all speculation.
At the time that summary judgment was considered and decided, what was the procedural, status of the case? Was discovery completed at that point?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
We were moving to trial pretty quickly.
So trial was soon thereafter.
That's right, Your Honor. There's not going to be any more evidence, certainly not from Mr. Jimenez-Arias, because as the court is undoubtedly aware, we filed a suggestion of death just a few weeks ago. Mr. Jimenez-Arias has unfortunately passed away. But we were on our way to trial, Your Honor. The evidence is complete. But let's talk about what he said out of his mouth, because that's important context. He didn't apply or work with DBCP. He never saw a container of DBCP and couldn't recognize one. He only worked on the patio at the farm.
Well, didn't he say he walked into the farming area?
And he did say that, and I want to talk about that in particular. We got distracted by a different question. The plaintiffs want to infer that he went every afternoon, but he didn't. He was asked directly, and this is at Appendix Tab 1C, Exhibit 1 to our motion for summary judgment at 34, page 34, 17 through 20. He was asked, working as a quality inspector, did you always work in that area of the plant, of the packing plant? Most of the time I did. Every once in a while, we will go to visit the farm, inside the farm. You mean in the fields. So we know that only every once in a while.
Okay, was that quantified? Every once in a while?
No,
was it 100 times, 1,000, 5 times?
We don't know.
Okay, a reasonable inference could be a lot of times.
Why? Every once in a while, you cannot draw a reasonable inference from the statement every once in a while.
As to what that means, though, a reasonable inference, somebody could draw a different reasonable inference as to what every once in a while means.
Well, they certainly could, but it certainly doesn't mean it's many times. It certainly doesn't mean it's regular. It certainly doesn't mean it's frequent. It means that every once in a while, he would go into the fields.
Is that the standard you're suggesting that we use, the frequency, regularity, proximity test?
I'm saying that is one thing that the court can choose from. There is, at least to my reading, a bit of a hole in Hawaii's jurisprudence on this subject. We know that Hawaii follows substantial factor. A substantial factor presumes, in fact, it's a precedent, is that there was actual exposure.
But so, we haven't always applied substantial factor in toxic tort type cases, correct?
Like
in the Smith case.
Right.
You know, we adopted market share liability there without the proof that the defendant's conduct, a specific defendant's conduct, was a substantial factor.
But with market share liability, like substantial factor, assumes some level of exposure. What is that level of exposure going to be? Today, there are really three camps. The most rigorous is from my home state of Texas and the Third Circuit, where the plaintiff has to prove what the dose of the product is that would cause harm, the harm about which she or he complains. The second thing that he or she would then have to prove is that he or she was exposed to that level. The next camp is probably the majority rule. It comes from the Fourth Circuit case in Lorman. Like all of this, it comes from asbestos, because asbestos is so widespread, or the asbestos litigation. It is the frequent, regular, and proximate test. The third rule really is a single jurisdiction. It's Washington State. It only has been applied in asbestos cases, and it's a multi-factor test, which doesn't require frequent, regular, approximate exposure. In fact, let me say it another way. Both the more rigorous test and frequent, regular, and proximate talk about direct exposure, identifiable exposure to the product. This third, the Washington State test, out of a case called Lockwood, came around to deal with a scenario where the plaintiff could not identify his exposure. But frequent, regular, and proximate also is a way to carve people out, to eliminate plaintiffs like Mr. Jimenez-Arias here, where he cannot testify to his own exposure. That's what we have. We have a man who the most you can say about him was he was on a farm where the product was applied. You could say, well, maybe he was exposed to cut fruit. But there's no evidence that DVCP was in the cut fruit. You can say a lot of things. Those are not reasonable inferences. Those are pure speculation.
Has anyone adopted the restatement thirds approach to causation?
You know, Your Honor, I know this, but I don't remember it. If you'd remind me, I'd be happy to address that.
Right. It's the from section...
Comment G, section 26.
Right.
Yeah, what is the standard?
For exposure to the agent, second, general causation, and third, specific causation.
Well, I mean, many courts have considered that, right? I mean, the whole paradigm in toxic tort litigation is you first prove general causation, that is, the product is capable of doing what the plaintiff...
And that's not an issue here, right?
That's not an issue. In general causation for DBCP at high enough dose can cause at least some of the conditions that Mr. Jimenez-Arias complains about. So others are hotly disputed.
And so the issues here are specific causation and whether or not he was exposed, right?
Well, specific causation would flow from whether or not he was exposed.
Right.
Because if he's not exposed, as we contend, and which is why we contend summary judgment is proper, specific causation is eliminated. And before I run out of time, we also have the question of the reversal of the exclusion of Dr. DeBartolomeus. The Court of Appeals simply applied the wrong test. The test is Hawaii Rule of Evidence 702, relevance and reliability. The Court of Appeals didn't consider that in any way. And then it simply reviewed it de novo. But the question of evidence is always an abuse of discretion.
But the issue of whether or not it is relevant, isn't that a question of law? Wouldn't that be de novo?
When we're not contending it's not relevant, Your Honor, this is a question of reliability, because what Judge Chang found was there wasn't a factual predicate for Dr. DeBartolomeus's opinions. That goes to reliability. That is reviewed for abuse of discretion. I see I have 9.5 minutes left. I'm on your schedule, Your Honor.
I mean, essentially your argument is that the court just conflated the standards of a motion in limine and an MSJ.
That's exactly right. Well, the court applied the wrong standard. That's exactly right. The standard that the court should have approached the question of the exclusion of Dr. DeBartolomeus was under Rule 702, and then we're looking at reliability because that's what Judge Chang's findings went to, and then it's reviewed for an abuse of discretion. The Court of Appeals did none of that.
I understand.
Thank you. We'll please go ahead and reserve your time, rebuttal time. Mr. Massey.
Justices, I'm just going to introduce Mr. Massey, who will be making the argument.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court, Jonathan Massey for the plaintiffs in this case. I'd like to make three essential arguments today. First is that there was ample evidence of the plaintiff's exposure to DBCP in this case, more than enough to satisfy the plaintiff's burden on summary judgment. Second, the court should refrain from creating any rigid or artificial rules regarding exposure like the ones the defendant advocates. Hawaii law already requires that a toxic tort plaintiff provide sufficient exposure to satisfy Hawaii's causation standards, and that's all that Hawaii law should require. And third, I'll deal with the Intermediate Court of Appeals exclusion of the expert testimony. But first, let me start the evidence regarding exposure in this case, because Del Monte applied only Dow manufactured DBCP on the 15 Bandego plantations between in the 2.5 years that Mr. Jimenez Arias worked between 1970 and 1973. There was a lot of DBCP. Del Monte had between 250,000 and 500,000 plants. There were 1,400 to 1,800 per acre. Each of those plants got 6 to 8 injections of DBCP twice a year.
In terms of, you say the plants got the injection. Well, can you explain what the record shows in terms of how the DBCP was applied?
Yes, it was applied in hand injections. And this is at the Murray Deposition, Tab 2C, Exhibits 6 and 7, and also Interrogatory 3, which is Tab 2C, Exhibit 2. So there were people went out into the fields with at first they were in the warehouse where the DBCP was loaded into the injectors. And that's where spills could occur because it was, in some instances, it was in drums. Dr. DeMaltolomes also testified that it was in granular form in bags as well. But it would be mixed and loaded into the injectors, and it would be aromatic. So there would be the warehouse.
Opposing counsel represented that it was all in liquid form. Are you saying that the record does not show that?
The record does not show that. The record shows
that. There were some of the DBCP was actually in sacks?
In granular form, yes. It's in Dr. DeBartolome's reply declaration that's in the record, yes. And okay. So there's a dispute about that. And even if it were in drums, it could be, he testified, it could be spilled. It was often spilled because you had to pour it into the injectors and it would be aromized.
How large are these injectors?
They're enough to be carried by one person. So they're heavy, but they would be refilled during the day, several times usually. So that meant that people were going back and forth to the warehouse.
And what does the record show as to how they were injected?
Well, you stick it into the ground and you squeeze it. So and the record shows that DBCP stays in the ground and continues to vaporize into the air. So it's not that you have to be present immediately when the injector is going in. This is in the record at Tab 2C, Exhibit 4, Section 4.4.1, where Dr. DeBartolomes goes through the studies showing how the DBCP over time will continue to vaporize. It has a half-life of 8 to 46 days in the atmosphere, and it depends on the winds as to how long it stays in the particular area. But he testified that in a banana canopy, the banana plants create a canopy over the ground, and so the air would be the DBCP
were
would be
injections
emitted.
Occurring while with plants that were in the stage of growing or
yes.
already
so,
grown?
Yes. So they're, as they're growing, people go out into the, you know.
Why is it twice a year in the spring and the fall?
Well, you'd have to ask the defendants of why they picked that, but that's how it works.
Okay.
And the evidence.
Also, just going back, it's interesting in understanding how this chemical was used, but was there evidence also about if it rained or got wet and how that may have interacted with this chemical?
There is in this sense that the studies on which Dr. DeBartolomes relied on actual government studies and academic studies of exposure. He went out, or he didn't go out, he read in places like the Federal Register how these calculations were made. He did the same thing he did for the US EPA in the state of California for 20 years in assessing occupational environmental risk. And one way you do it is by looking at published studies. So there are studies, and that's table one in our response. Those are that's hard scientific data about what the ambient concentration of DBCP actually is in field tests. And now the defendants will say, well, those field tests are different from ARC tests because they involve pineapple trees in many instances, and they involve tractor injections rather than hand injections. But the evidence shows that underestimates the concentration of DBCP in the air by maybe a factor of 10, because pineapples don't create the same canopy effect as banana trees, and hand injectors are much less precise, really, than tractors. And their tractor would go down deeper. The hand injectors can't go down that deep. So it is true that the studies don't line up 100%, but the bias is in our favor. It's an underestimation of the exposure. So those field studies would account for things like rain. They would account for things like wind. They account for the real-world conditions in which agricultural workers operate when they use DBCP. That's the best we have. And the defendants, it's, you know, one of the arguments against their proximate, against some of their causation rules is they have all the evidence. I mean, the individual workers, especially the workers here who are, you know, not sophisticated, not educated, they're not wearing dosimeters, you know.
Like I'm just really curious, how does anyone satisfy the Texas rule?
Well, I don't think you should adopt the Texas rule. I think that's a good argument, that it would never be satisfied in any of the toxic tort cases, any of the classic lead DBCP, PCBs. It's not the test that Hawaii should adopt. The Ninth Circuit in 1992, in an opinion by Judge William Fletcher, wrote the Hawaii asbestos cases, which involved sailors from World War II who had been exposed to asbestos. And he went through all these causation and exposure tests. And he was predicting Hawaii law. And he's not you. You're the ultimate authority on Hawaii law. He's a federal judge. But for 34 years, the law has followed what Judge Fletcher said, which is, and I could read you some of his quotes from his opinion, that basically you don't have to prove the kinds of things the defendants are asking for here. He said Hawaii would reject the restrictive approach that demands particularized proof that a plaintiff came into contact with the manufacturer's product. He said, this is his quote, as long as a plaintiff introduces evidence suggesting that the products of a particular defendant were present at the worksite and thus could be said to have contributed to the asbestos exposure, she can recover from that defendant. That's at page 817 of 960 F second. And
what are your thoughts on the restatement's approach to toxic tort causation, restatement third?
Well, so I've noticed that the restatement in the proposed final draft of Section 28 says that courts should be cautious about formulating bright-line legal rules or concluding that reasonable minds cannot differ about factual causation. I think the restatement third is taking a step towards us, frankly, in saying allow the plaintiffs to present sufficient evidence of exposure to meet the whatever the relevant causation standard is. I would urge this court to do what you did in the estate of Frey case, which is a 2020 decision. It was a medical malpractice case where the issue was that the loss of basically the loss of chance doctrine. You know, if a patient comes into a surgery and the patient's already very sick and the surgeon makes a mistake, but the patient may not have survived anyway, does the patient have a claim? And this court said we already addressed that with our normal substantial factor test. We can just fold in the inquiry that you are making, defendants, and we will just treat that as part of the substantial causation test. And that's what I would urge this court to do today, that the arguments, we have to prove sufficient exposure to meet the substantial factor test or whatever the relevant test is. Maybe it's market share, but whatever the test for causation is, exposure can just be the sufficient evidence to meet that test. You don't need to create a specific rule that really comes from the asbestos context.
I have a more, I'm sorry, and this is not something that's in the briefs, but I'm just wondering, why are we addressing Hawaii law here when these activities took place in other countries?
Right. The application of Hawaii law was part of the earlier stages of the case.
And it seems like everyone is in agreement
we're
applying Hawaii law here.
Yes.
All right. So
yes.
That's just an agreement.
Yes. We're not, as the case comes before you, that's right.
I didn't see any arguments on
that
on appeal.
No, there isn't. I mean, we think Hawaii law on exposure is quite favorable to us. Not only the Ninth Circuit decision from 34 years ago, but then last year in the case involving the drinking water contamination at Pearl Harbor, the Joint Base Pearl Harbor-Hickam, there is a case called Freight, which was the suit by the people whose drinking water had been contaminated. And the federal district court, again, it's not you, it's not the Hawaii Supreme Court, but it's applying the same principles that Judge Fletcher announced 34 years ago. That district court said there was no need for proof of specific evidence of exposure or dose. The court said that because the plaintiffs experienced dizziness, headaches, gastrointestinal distress, which would have been associated with consumption of jet fuel, they could recover, even though obviously those are very generalized symptoms. People get, you know, headaches all the time. It's not always from jet fuel. But the court said, quote, the specific amount of jet fuel chemicals that were released into the water supply and that reached the individual homes is not capable of being reliably calculated. But the court also finds that the actual dose to which each plaintiff was exposed is not required to be proved. And, you know, the same thing would have been true for the sailors in the Ninth Circuit case 34 years ago. They were all on ships during World War II. Nobody remembered where there's asbestos in the valves that they were working on. They just had to show that they, that in general, the ships had asbestos products on them, that they were involved, they were on that ship, and that was enough. And let me go back a little bit to the facts of this case, because I do think there's more to be said about the exposure of Mr. Jimenez-Arias to DBCP. He, as we said, he was essentially living on the farms. And there were thousands, we calculate from the numbers I gave you earlier, there were thousands of gallons of DBCP being applied every year. He was eating on the farm, sleeping on the farm, working every week. He went every 8 days, he got a day off. So he was living there. He was drinking the water. He was breathing everything. So there were four pathways that we argued below were gateways to his exposure. The first was in the morning when he got up, he went to the packing plant. And the table two, which is in our brief too, shows what the scenarios would be for his ambient exposure to DBCP in the packing plant. And it shows that even at the most conservative estimates of the ambient concentration, even with the most conservative numbers, he would have been exposed to 50 times the EPA standard for DBCP exposure just from working in the packing plant. That's table 2C, exhibit 4, section 4.5. So a lot of the quibbling about, well, how much was it, how much was he exposed, is kind of irrelevant given the enormity of the enormity by which he exceeded the EPA standard. The second way he was exposed was he went into the fields after lunch, and there was a discussion before about how often did he go. Let's assume he went only once a week at each farm he went to. Let's say he worked in the morning at the packing plant, went one time at each farm into the field, which is, I think, a pretty conservative assumption given that his testimony suggests it was more regular than that. But anyway, he still would have experienced at least 200 times more exposure than the EPA standard. And it could have been much, much higher. Table 2 suggests it could have been 48,000 times the EPA standard just from going into the fields once in the afternoons. And so the evidence was that the injections occurred in the morning. So counsel on my friend on the other side is right.
Are you suggesting, there's a position that, you know, the dose, you know, makes the poison. We've all heard that. But are you suggesting just one instance of going out in the field, you establishing some sort of physical presence in that context one time gets you by an MSJ motion?
It actually does, Your Honor. I mean, that's basically in Table 2. If you look at if I get Table 2 in front of me, I'm apologize.
You know, because I looked at the Karazi study that you said, and that was a study that really was focused on direct contact with the DBCP.
Right, and I think it involved people wearing protective equipment too, which the plaintiff here didn't have. And so you're right that in some ways it was a more direct exposure. But with the way Dr. DiBartolomeo's looked at it was to say, what is the ambient air concentration in the real world in these instances? What is in a banana, for example, right, in a pineapple plant, in a pineapple field where there's no canopy, you know, that basically you get one part per billion exposure from walking through a pineapple field after DBCP application, and it lasts for several days. Now, in a canopy with the banana plants, you get like 1,000 times more because there's no air circulation. And that's the real-world data on which he's relying. So I think that is enough to get past motion for summary judgment.
And analogized this particular toxic substance to asbestos. Asbestos, it's pretty clear cut, at least in the science, that, you know, one exposure, you're in the boiler room one time, you know, you get it. So you're suggesting that with this substance, one dose would, or one act of physical presence, let's say modern day times, I'm a delivery driver, I drop off something where there's some toxic fumigation in some building, that one time that Amazon driver is exposed to it would be enough to overcome a Rule 56 motion?
No, Your Honor. I mean, what I'm talking about is the one time when you walk into a banana canopy where it's like a fog of the exposure.
Was that on the record, or was it just once in a while he was in a generic field, or was there canopy in the record here?
Yes. Well, the banana fields are canopies. Yes. So when he talks about going out into the fields, he's talking about going into a situation where there is a canopy. Yes. And I'm not saying that, you know, again, I don't think we're taking the position that it's one time. It's that the most conservative assumptions are enormously favorable to us because they far exceed the EPA standard. And so I don't think we're not arguing for an extreme position that like the Amazon driver. We're saying if you look, there's enough here for summary judgment to say that the evidence shows that there was, that there was exposure.
What's your position on the frequency, proximity, regularity standard?
So I don't think the court needs to adopt it because, well, first, it's been rejected by a lot of states. I mean, we can run through the numbers, but I don't think it's the majority rule. But in any event, I don't think it's consistent with Hawaii law, the way that Judge Fletcher articulated and the way it's been here for 34 years. But we would meet it anyway because there was frequency. He was there 2.5 years. There was proximity. He was on the plantation, living on the plantation, and it was very regular. He was there all the time.
In your view, is that standard essentially or the functional equivalent of the substantial factor standard? And that Fowler case kind of mentioned that.
I think it is. I think that you could say we believe that our substantial factor test already incorporates the plaintiff's burden to prove sufficient exposure. And I think these kind of rigid rules about you'd have to prove proximity, maybe sometimes with asbestos you do because it's not as aromatic. You have to look at the context. I don't think that every toxic tort case is the same. I don't think the court should take a rule that really came out of asbestos and apply it to all toxic tort cases. I think your law is already flexible enough to deal with that without making a rigid or arbitrary rule. But can I go back just for a moment? Because we did hear that that Mr. Jimenez Arias never saw the DBCP being applied. And what I wanted to say was that it was applied in the morning and he was in the fields in the afternoon. So that's tabs 2C, exhibit 4 at section 4.3.2. And he also testified that, and this is evidence, it's admittedly ambiguous, but I think it construed in his favor, would be that he could smell the DBCP that on occasion. And that's tab 4D, page 117. And, of course, any odor.
Did he identify it as
no.
DBCP or he smelled something?
He smelled something. But, of course, this is summary judgment. You know, this is where the evidence, where the plaintiff's burden.
Was there any evidence of other things being injected or sprayed?
No.
Okay.
And why would you reasonably infer that it was that particular chemical that he was smelling?
Well, he was being asked about DBCP in his deposition, and that was the only chemical that we heard about in the that's in the record. And so, if the defendants want to put in additional evidence to refute that, it's up to them. That's their burden. I think we've met the initial summary judgment burden on our side, and I think he also testified that in tab 1C at page 114, he said, I do know that people applied it without knowing what was being applied, referring to DBCP. So he didn't witness it, but he didn't need to because he was in the fields in the afternoon. It was being applied in the morning. And so anyway, I think that is...
Mr. Massey, I have a question.
Yes.
Earlier you mentioned that the containers were in the warehouses transferred into injectors there. And that I think I heard you say, and there's some evidence that there could be spills. I think I heard the word could. Is there evidence that there were spills in the warehouse area?
I don't I think that there was only generalized reference to spills. I don't think anyone personally testified that.
These were, okay, I'm so sorry. And these were the warehouses where Mr. Arias would have been sleeping.
He rested during the day.
These are the same areas, at least there's testimony in your view, that the transfer from the containers to the injectors occurred in these same warehouses.
That's right. Okay. That's right. And I think also it's relevant here that we asked the defendants how far were the warehouses and how far were the packing plants and his house from the fields where the injections were actually occurring? And those were interrogatories 21 and 24 that are in the record at, I think it's tab 2C, exhibit 2. And the defendants never responded. They did not say the house was very far away from the field. There's no way the DBCP vapors could have come into the house where he slept every single night. They did not say the packing plant is really far away from the field. And this court decided in a case called Stender against Vincent in 2000 that an adverse inference can be drawn from a defendant's failure to produce evidence or a party's failure to produce evidence, even if it's not like deliberate destruction of the evidence, even if but if it's evidence that you had and you no longer have and you don't produce it in court, an adverse inference could be drawn. And I think that's quite reasonable here. And that's another argument against the reasonable proximity test or these kinds of rigid requirements. When you're going back, these are cases are 29 years old. And in many toxic tort cases, you're going to have plaintiffs who are poorly educated, relatively powerless people who don't have the access to the information that the defendants do. The defendants have information about they have the map of the plantation. They knew where the buildings were. They have evidence as to, or they should have evidence as to what their monitoring was, of what the ambient concentrations of the air was. Were they not doing any safety testing at all? Hard to believe, but if it is, then that's even worse. But in many toxic tort cases, the only relevant evidence of exposure is really going to be the hands of the defendants. And so I don't think you should adopt a rule that basically switches the table around and forces the plaintiffs to come up with evidence that they can't possibly come up with and gives the defendants zero incentive to save anything. They're going to just want to get rid of all the documentation as soon as possible about what went on at their facilities. So this is not a good rule for the way that Hawaii, which has suffered environmental damage. You know, there's DBCP contamination in the community of Kunia, just here on Oahu, where there was drinking water that was contaminated 50 times the level of EPA standards. And that the pineapple workers on Lanai and Molokai were wearing protective equipment, and they've suffered fertility problems themselves. And so I don't think it's in Hawaii's interest to sort of give the incentives to the defendants to make more environmental mischief. And just to circle back a little bit, I mean, we did talk about the napping in the warehouses, the sleeping in the house. These are all ways that Mr. Jimenez Arias was exposed to DBCP. And at the end of the day, all of this is confirmed by the medical expert, Dr. Schlegel, who examined Mr. Jimenez Arias and did a differential diagnosis and said, let's look at his body. You know, look at his abnormal sperm count, look at his abnormal sperm motility, look at the fact that his wife had 3 spontaneous abortions, look at the fact that his testes are soft and abnormally small. These are all consistent with exposure to DBCP. And Dr. DeBartolomes said all of this, his injuries are consistent with studies of agricultural workers in many countries that have been exposed to DBCP. And that's tab 2C, exhibit 4, section 3.32. And Dr. Schlegel's declaration or his report is tab 2C, exhibit 3. So this is all confirmatory. It's not the only evidence that I think you would rely on in finding exposure, but you would say, are the plaintiff's injuries consistent with what this substance is known to cause? And the answer is yes.
Could you address the point two, which is the admissibility?
Yes, I'm sorry. So I think what the Intermediate Court of Appeals said was that it applied the abuse of discretion test at page 17 of its opinion. It says we review the exclusion of expert testimony under an abuse of discretion test. And then it said that the trial court based its exclusion on a clearly erroneous finding that there was no exposure, or you could say it was a legally invalid finding of there was no exposure, no evidence of exposure. And so that a legally invalid finding or a clearly erroneous finding is automatically an abuse of discretion. I think that's pretty well settled. Just to cite a case, if you'd like, the matter of Elaine Emma Short, which is 156 Hawaii 2025, basically a clearly erroneous or legally invalid finding is automatically an abuse of discretion. So I don't think the Intermediate Court of Appeals was doing anything wrong.
All right.
If I could just say one last thing, I wanted to preview that we'll be filing in this court a motion for an order allowing the four remaining plaintiffs who are not in this case, but were in the case in the Court of Appeals, to proceed in the circuit court while this court is considering Mr. Jimenez Arias' case. In other words, there are four other people who are not here today whose cases were remanded by the Intermediate Court of Appeals down to the circuit court. And those cases have been going on, you know, for 29 years. Those plaintiffs are not in poor health. And so we think there's good cause to allow them to proceed in the circuit court while your honors are considering this case. And I'm just previewing that. We'll be filing a formal motion, but I wanted to mention it since we're all here today.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, just had a quick procedure if I may. Just a procedural question. You know, I saw that you had noted as a point of error the Shell's MSJ, but I didn't see a specific point of error on this defendant's SJ. Did I miss that?
I believe there was. I'm sorry. I will double check that, Your Honor, if that's I believe it's listed in the Intermediate Court of Appeals opinion, but I don't have it in front of me at this moment.
I was looking at your opening brief from the ICA.
Oh, in the opening brief in the Intermediate Court of Appeals.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
You can take a look later.
I apologize for not being able to respond to that. Well, how would you like me to respond? Look to send something to the court?
We'll double check. I just wanted to know if you caught that off the top of your head, if I missed something.
I'm sorry. No. I doubt Your Honor missed anything, but I will.
It's fine. Thank
I appreciate
you.
It.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Brehm, rebuttal.
May it please the court, part two. I made a list of things that my good friend Mr. Massey went through. I wish the court had asked him on more than one occasion, where's the record evidence of that? But let's go through what we do know. Mr. Jimenez Arias was not a field worker. He was not an applicator. He testified himself that he had never used the product. He testified himself that he couldn't identify a container of DDCP. He does not have direct exposure. The court's going to have to, for the plaintiffs to prevail, the court's going to have to infer that from the facts we do have. Mr. Massey talked a number of times about a Ninth Circuit case from 37 years ago by Judge Fletcher. The Ninth Circuit misinterpreted its own authority there, or the authorities it was citing. The Ninth Circuit in that case cites the Washington State case, Lockwood, that I brought up to the attention of the court in my argument. Lockwood does not stand for the proposition that the mere presence on the farm or in a facility is enough to get a plaintiff to the jury. That premise has been rejected repeatedly, and it started with the Third Circuit's decision in a very prominent asbestos case called In Re Paoli, P-A-O-L-I. The Washington State test allows circumstantial evidence, but then lists seven factors that must be met. There's no evidence that those are met here today. Mr. Massey said repeatedly that the exposures, according to Dr. DeBartolomis, would have exceeded the EPA standard. But the EPA standard, like all regulatory standards, is not a no effect level or a first known adverse effect level. They always have safety factors in it. You can read it in the standard itself. It is a much lower figure than the actual amount or the actual dose of DBCP or any product known to cause harm. The other thing we know is that DBCP is indisputably dose responsive. There used to be, when I was much younger and much younger than anybody on the court, and I'm much older than anybody on the court, a Brill Cream commercial, a little dab will do you. There's no evidence that a little dab of DBCP will do you. Chief Justice McKenna asked about whether the product came in bags. It indisputably was a liquid. And the citation for that, and we cited this, is tab 1C, exhibit 5, the Donald Murray Depot. Mr. Murray was Del Monte's corporate representative. And he was asked about this, and he says, he was asked by Mr. Chi, as a matter of fact, are you familiar with the fact that DBCP used by Bandeco came with a label? Yes, it did. The DBCP that arrived into the farms arrived in drums. The product was liquid. There's no dispute that DBCP is a liquid product and that the bags that Mr. Jimenez Arias testified to seeing could not have possibly been DBCP.
Can you address the issue of potentials for spills in the area where Mr. Jimenez Arias slept in the warehouse?
There is no evidence of that in the summary judgment record at all. In fact, we know from Mr. again, the evidence of what went on in that warehouse when Mr. Jimenez Arias was there only comes out of his mouth. And we have that testimony. And he did not testify to spills, to seeing injectors filled with DBCP, to seeing barrel or drums of DBCP. He testified to bags.
Yeah, I think I took it as the argument is those involved in the injection process having some evidence from them that the transfer was made in these warehouses to the injectors and that there could be spills in that process.
There is no evidence of that with regard to the Del Monte plaintiffs. There is evidence of that regarding Dole plaintiffs. But even if you accept that fact as a true statement, at the time, there's no evidence of that with regard to Mr. Jimenez Arias. He's the one that was in the warehouse. He told us what he saw, and he'd never mentioned that one time. The summary judgment record, the plaintiff's response to our motion for summary judgment, does not include that evidence. And that's my overarching point. If the court, when it's considering this, when it takes the case under advisement, please, please, please look at what the actual evidence in the summary judgment record is. The actual evidence. And the evidence is that DBCP was used on these farms twice a year for 2 months at a time. That's as close as Mr. Jimenez Arias can get to DBCP. But even then, Dr. DeBartolomis, in the table two that Mr. Massey cited to you, which is, you can find it on page 7 of the response to our petition. He says that he's only considering DBCP for 1 week after the application. So what we know here is you have 8 weeks of application twice a year. That means that there's 44 weeks, over 240 days, when there are no applications. You would have to hit it exactly correctly for Mr. Jimenez Arias to be in the same place within 1 week of a DBCP application, even if you credited that. There is no direct evidence of his exposure.
Can you address, you know, we know that if you have mesothelioma, you've been exposed to asbestos. Now, in sort of the wrap-up from the plaintiffs, they mentioned that the medical evidence, that itself, the injuries sustained, suggested causation. Can you address that?
Your Honor, that is what, in the case law, is working backward. That has been universally rejected. You can't be a plaintiff and say, I have condition X. Condition X is known to be caused by this compound.
But combined with, let's say, a little bit of physical presence, and you're suggesting there was a little bit of physical presence, I think. What about that? The two combined. I'm not just saying pure injury causation.
There is no case in the country that stands for that proposition. I don't believe, Your Honor. I am a toxic tort lawyer. You would not be able to, otherwise you'd always be able to say, somewhere in this big facility was compound X. I have disease Y that's associated with it. I never saw it. I never smelled it. I never heard it. I never perceived it, but my condition proves that it was. But let's talk about this. You know, male testicular failure is found in 2 to 4% of all men in this country, where good medical care. Mr. Massey referred to spontaneous abortions or miscarriages. That is a non-specific cause. Are we going to extrapolate from things that occur idiopathically or due to other causes to causation in a toxic tort case? I would urge the court that that's exactly the wrong rule and would put this state in as a definite outlier in the jurisprudence across the country. And I see I'm out of time, but I would be happy to answer any further questions.
There being none. At this time, this court will take this matter under advisement. Thank you to counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Eku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'o malolo ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolokolo ki eke hanahana. This honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.